Good morning, Los Angeles, and welcome to another edition of the Weekend Warrior Show. I'm your host, Dr. Robert Clapper. I'm an orthopedic surgeon at Cedars-Sinai, 30 years. Thanks so much for listening each and every Saturday, telling your friends. It's such a joy, just such a pleasure. I'm tired. 10 hours, I stood on my feet yesterday. But it's so worth it. What a privilege it is for me to try to figure out the machinery of how the body is made. I may have done 15,000 surgeries over these 30 years, but I'm so excited to do the next one because I get that much closer to trying to figure out how the body works. You got to ask yourself, no one touched Klay Thompson. How did he tear the ligament in his knee? You got to ask yourself, Boogie Cousins collided kneecaps, bumped knees, they said, and he tore his ACL. How does that, why do you tear your ACL? As I told Steve Mason, and I'm going to tell you guys today, there are three things that I see that give stability to your knee joint. One, the very shape of the bones that connect. You know, if you feel right underneath the skin of your kneecap right now, go ahead and feel your knee. And you can feel that Oreo cookie, your kneecap, right under the skin. Feels flat, doesn't it? Like an Oreo cookie. But actually, inside the knee joint, there is a ridge. There's a Santa Monica mountain. It's not flat. That's on the inner surface of your kneecap. And that ridge rides in a female valley. Male is the ridge. The female is the valley groove. That's the end of your thigh bone, your femur. So that your kneecap perfectly tracks down the center when you get up from a seated chair to stand up, when you walk and when you run. It's not a flat Oreo cookie that can slide and dislocate side to side. No, it actually stays true. So the geometry of the bone, how the femur meets the tibia, it's not two ends of a pencil that's snapped in half that can be wobbly. It's actually male, female. They fit into each other. So the geometry of how the bone is shaped gives you stability. That's number one. Number two, go ahead and look at your hand and wiggle your index finger. See how wobbly it is. Now go ahead and tighten your muscles in your hand. Try to wiggle your finger now. It don't move. So you can give stability to the joint by firing your muscles, your quadriceps, your hamstring muscles above your knee, your calf muscles below your knee. You fire those muscles with your brain consciously, and you can now land from a jump knowing your knee won't collapse because your muscles are firing. So that's the second reason for stability. And the third is a clapper vision for you. Just like a kickstand is bolted to the bicycle to keep it from falling over, the ligament is bolted into the bone. And there's four of them. Big toe side of your knee, the medial collateral ligament. The little toe side of your knee, the lateral collateral ligament. It's a north-south structure. Looks like a piece of canvas bolted from femur to tibia and keeps you stable side to side. But our knees are not just hinges. There's rotation. You walk on sand. You walk on gravel. You can't just have a hinge. You need a little bit of wiggle room. It needs to rotate a little bit. Well, what gives you stability for rotation? The genius of who made our bodies gave us two ligaments in the center of your knee that cross. And in Latin, the word for cross is cruciate. The one in front is called anterior. The one in the back is called posterior. So these canvas rope-like structures that bolt into the bone is the third reason for stability of the joint. The shape of the bone, the firing of the muscle, and actually the ligament itself. So if there's any kind of weakness or electronic neuromuscular problem with how the muscles fire, then you can understand a 7-foot big man who twists his knee and the muscles are not quite firing in tune with each other. All of that force, can you imagine what Boogie Cousins' leg must weigh? All of that force goes through that small little ligament in the center of his knee and snap. Same thing for Klay Thompson. This is where we see this non-contact ACL that occurs. And it's fascinating for me as a surgeon to fix it. Because when I use the arthroscope to look in the knee and see the ruptured ligament, I harvest a graft to use as a new ligament. But guess where I put the new ligament? This is the value of the arthroscope. It tells me and shows me where God put the original one, and that's where I drill the tunnel. That's where I put the new one. If you don't put it exactly where the old one was, you will have a stiff knee, it won't straighten, it won't bend, and you're going to have pain, and you'll probably rupture it again. So it's incumbent upon the surgeon. My dad was a carpenter, right? He taught me, measure twice, cut once. I got to put that ligament exactly back where it came from with the new ligament. Because if you're off by a millimeter, you won't have a perfect result. Well, not a millimeter, but that's the goal. That's the aim. So there you go for ACLs, and I hope that explains a little bit. Knowing that Fred Dreyer would be my guest today, I asked him, how could you weigh 215 pounds when you're playing, even though you're 6'6" and you had the wingspan of Will Chamberlain? Yet those 300-pound linemen, they smack into you. I mean, trust me, they wanted to crush you. How did you survive to have such a stellar career? And Fred Dreyer said, because I could look at that offensive lineman before the ball was snapped. They couldn't help themselves but lift their helmet up and then go back down again to look at me. And then I knew they were looking for me. So I knew nonverbal communication, how to get around them. So I love the world of art, the world of sports, and the world of medicine. Where do you see the Fred Dreyer nonverbal communication in art? For me, it's the drummer for the Beatles, Ringo Starr. Shea Stadium, 1965, 50,000 women screaming. He can't hear the music. There's no earbuds in 1965. And he's sitting behind Paul McCartney, George Harrison. He's not able, and John Lennon, and he's not able to hear them. But he used nonverbal communication. He watched how their feet were, their hands were, because of so many years of playing together. There's the nonverbal communication in art. Listen to what Ringo Starr had to put up with.
Well, she loves you.
Oh, my God. Listen to that crowd. He's behind the guitar players. The speakers are over his head. He hasn't got a clue. So Paul McCartney and Ringo Starr are interviewed. And this is the trick. This is the story. Listen to them describe playing so much together is what gave them the secret. That's the only way he could do it in a stadium. Because in the studio, listen to Paul McCartney talk about the quietness of being together with George Martin in a studio. A lot different because you can see your bandmates. You can hear your bandmates. This is the studio versus Shea Stadium.
We'd come in here, and it was only me and John knew what we were going to do that day because we'd just written it. George Martin had come down from the sort of grown-ups box, and he'd come down and he'd sort of say, what are we going to do, chaps? So we go, okay, if there's anything that you want, or whatever it was, you know. And in that next 1.5 hours, we'd make that song.
And then when we end up with Shea, because that is the biggest thing we'd ever done.
Big.
It was like far out. It was like what?
Far out.
At New York's Shea Stadium, in August of 1965, they played before 56,000 fans.
Screaming fans. They can't hear anything.
I mean, at first, that screaming was great because it meant we were a success. It was just like, she loved it. And it's like, hey, whoa. And after a while, it was like, I can't hear you. Wait a minute, you know.
But it had become part of it.
Yeah.
It was like, that's what happens when we go on stage. This is what happens.
Yeah.
And we did diminish a little as musicians. Though it sounds good.
But Ringo, you couldn't hear. How did you keep time? No earbuds.
We played our best no matter what. And I couldn't hear them.
I couldn't hear them.
I was playing, you know, to his foot tapping, to John's bouncing, you know, and when they went, I couldn't hear that. I just saw the head. Oh, it's the woo!
You knew it was time for
the bill.
And Paul McCartney really teaching us the secret.
Singing a song called Boys Ringo!
And the thing is, though, because we put in so many hours as kids, we instinctively knew what to do as a band. We were making a pretty good noise most of the time, not always.
Incredible to see it in art, nonverbal communication. In sports, we were blessed in Showtime to see Magic Johnson make the no-look pass. Here's Chick Hearn describing a pass to James Worthy without Magic Johnson even seeing him.
Rebounded by Jaminski once, twice, and then Worthy taps the ball to Magic. Magic's in the middle, Worthy to the right, Scott to the left. Magic no-look pass to Worthy! Magic Johnson passing the ball in such a deliberate and beautiful way tonight.
And here's Keith Erickson teaching Chick Hearn how Magic's able to do it because he never looks down.
Both clubs are out of fouls. Magic holds it up underneath. He gets to Nixon. Nixon scores. Magic Johnson's bullet pass. We're tied at 110 from behind. Long lead pass to Worthy underneath the score from Magic. How can Magic read that floor that well?
Dribbling the basketball. He never looks down.
Because he never looks down. He seems like he has more than two eyes. Here's Magic Johnson telling you, you actually have 100 eyes.
You know, when you're born, they tell us we only have two eyes. But that's not true. Actually, we have about 100 eyes. We just got to train ourselves to use all those eyes. For instance, say we're coming down the court on a fast break. Now you're looking to see who's behind you, who's in front of you, who's running fast, who's running slow, where's the defense, who's free, who's got a shot, who can block that shot, who's open, the passing lanes, the cracks, the seams. You're just moving fast. Now, who's going to see all of that with just two eyes?
Paul McCartney said, you just spent so many hours playing together. You've got 100 eyes. Here's Magic Johnson.
You got to train yourself. I say it again. You got to train yourself to use everything, to see the whole floor, to use all those eyes. Now, when I look side to side, I see a fan. I see two ladies. I see five men. I see a chair. I see a ladder. I see a basket. I see some bleachers. I see all of those things. Now, that's an exercise you can use for your eyes. Because passing is with your hands and your eyes.
And he loved to pass.
We're about to go into passing. And I really love this part of the game because passing, you make somebody else score 2 points. You set the offense up for another guy. And that's mental part of the game because you have to understand what type of pass you're going to make, whether it's a bounce pass, a chest pass, an overhead pass, or a baseball pass.
It's all in what you see. And that's the secret, is learning how to see differently by having a feeling. And that comes with time. You got to put the time in. You got to put the work in. But when you do, in your life, you develop a sixth sense, whether it's surgery, whether it's playing the drums, whether it's playing basketball or playing football. It's all about that feeling, that sixth sense you get when you do it enough. That's the part I love about getting older. Coming up next, we're going to get into nonverbal communication with the great Fred Dreyer, but the artistic part of his life, being an actor, meeting Andy Warhol, Howard Cosell. God, there's so much I want to talk to him about, and we'll get into it. Coming up next on the Weekend Warrior Show here on ESPN LA 710. I'm asked along the way. I got down on my knees, and I began to pray, I'm gonna stay, gonna stay. California dreaming. This is the Mamas and the Papas. Most of their songs, they only were together for 2.5 years. And most of their songs were written, including this one, on a cross-country trip in a van. It just, the songs would just pop into John Phillips' head. What an incredible songwriter and melodic human being he was. A whole lifetime compressed into 2.5 years. What a great time I'm having with the great Fred Dreyer. Fred, you must have seen, and you must see all of life through the eyes of an artist. It may be football and it may be collisions, but the craftiness and the intelligence, creativity you brought to not only surviving, which is what you have to do every play, and all it takes is one play and you're out, but to have such a long career. You were creative, you were an artist. And then, lo and behold, you actually become just an artist, not even an athlete anymore. I don't know, maybe the greatest artist to come out of the 20th century was Andy Warhol. How many people get to say that they knew Andy Warhol? You knew Andy Warhol. Tell me what it was like to know Andy Warhol.
He gave me his home phone number. And he said, I want you to call me anytime you want.
Oh, my God.
And I said, all right, I'm going to. Remember, you give me your phone number, I'm calling you. Goes, oh, you have to. You have to call me. A couple weeks passed. And I had visited him with my fiance at the time, and who was later my wife. We visited his studio.
The factory?
Yes.
Ugh.
We went down, we saw all the art, you know, and he was doing all of the sports, the greatest.
Muhammad Ali?
All the, yeah. Gretzky and Rod Gilbert and all the guys that I had known. And he was pointing out some art. He comes over to me and says, hey, look, if you see anything that you want, let me know. And I said, well, what do you mean? I want all of it.
Oh.
I was just joking. He says, no, really. He says, if you want anything, let me know and we'll work something out. And I never pushed it because I didn't want to. I didn't want to do that.
Right.
Now, over his shoulder, there was a fellow, Fred Hughes, was his manager, type of business associate at the time. He didn't like me, not because of anything.
Because Andy Warhol liked you, and he was jealous.
Well, yes, and he said, "Oh, here's a guy who's going to get in between me and Andy."
That's right.
So, so I called him one night and hello. He picks the phone up.
Oh my God.
I said, Andy, it's Fred here in LA. I said, what are you doing right now? He went, well, I was having some cocoa. What are you doing? I said, listen, I've got all that stuff that you wanted, all the junk mail that you wanted me to send you. I've been saving. I put in a box. And I said, and you're going to place it in that brand new dumpster. When I visited him, he says, I've got to show you something that's just fantastic. I just got it. I'm thinking, well, what did he get? I don't, what could he possibly get? So we walk around, we take an elevator, we go down another floor, go up, and we go into this floor, big wooden floor, art room, you know, like a basketball court. And in the middle of the room were these three brand new trash dumpsters. they didn't have a scratch on them. It was just, they were like monoliths in the middle of the room.
He loved this.
And it was loaded. Two of them were just jammed with junk mail.
I love it.
And so I said, what is this? And he says, I'm collecting junk mail. He says, I've got Burt Lancaster's junk mail, and he named all these people off. He said, I've got all their junk mail. He says, and I want your junk mail. So I said, okay, I'll put it together for you. So I loaded up this big box, and I mailed it off to him. I said, expect it. Thank you so much.
You know what his mishigas was and his genius all at the same time? I remember reading a quote, like, Andy, why are you painting Campbell's soup cans? Why are you wasting your time painting a bottle of Coca-Cola? And his answer will surprise you. He said, in England, the queen gets to live a life that you can never live because she's the queen of England. She gets to have certain things to eat, certain things to sleep in, certain houses to live. You can never touch that. But in America, Elizabeth Taylor doesn't get a better bottle of Coca-Cola than you. Elizabeth Taylor doesn't get, in his mind, she was the royalty. She doesn't get a better can of Campbell's soup than you. This junk mail is actually connects us all because we all get junk mail. And so he was, in his own mind, trying to level the playing field. So that you didn't, as much as he was obsessed with Elvis Presley and Marilyn Monroe and Fred Dreyer, he also wanted everyone to be at the same level because we all get junk mail.
It's all art.
Yeah, it's fascinating. He's
every aspect of life is art. It's an art form.
I actually am obsessed with the Mao Zedong paintings that he does. Mm-hmm. And it always fascinated me. Why did he portray Mao Zedong the way he did? And then I realized it's because on the little red book that Mao had in China, Mao is positioned exactly the way Leonardo da Vinci positions the Mona Lisa. And so what they recognized was when you – have you seen the Mona Lisa at the Louvre? Have you ever seen it in person?
No.
So the legend is that no matter where you stand in the room, she's following you.
Hmm.
And so in the Louvre – they've got the greatest art in the world. In this particular room, on a wall by itself, is the Mona Lisa. She doesn't share the wall with any other paintings, unlike the other walls. And they put a curved banister in front of the Mona Lisa because they want you to stand on this corner and notice that she's following you. Stand in front of her, she's following you. And then you go the curved banister to the other side.
Mm-hmm.
And I never understood, because they always said Leonardo da Vinci, a scientist, a mathematician, he figured out some geometry that makes this happen. And then I realized one day, no one taught me this, I figured out how Leonardo da Vinci did it. And that's what they do with Mao Zedong. So right now, Fred Dreyer, people can't see this, so I'm going to describe it. We are facing each other. My shoulders are facing you, my head is facing you, and my eyes are looking at you. Three different ways I'm with you. The Mona Lisa and the Mao Zedong that Andy Warhol portrayed, the shoulders are pointing towards the right corner of the room. The head is straight and the eyes are looking to the left. So when you see this portrait, you are being engaged in one of the three ways. So it feels like you're being tracked. It's fascinating. He recognized that.
Yeah.
And you were lucky enough to have met him and communicated with him. My God. All right. I have another one for you. Yeah.
When you get a moment, I'm gonna wrap up Andy for you.
Yeah, please.
A little quick story.
Tell me.
Right now. Okay. Rams are playing the Giants in New York.
Andy Warhol and the sentence, the Rams are playing the Giants, have never been put together before in Andy Warhol's life.
Well, when this builds to a black up, you can't believe it. So I call Andy.
Yeah.
I said, you want tickets? Now, Andy, sitting out in the crowd, I said, this is perfect for you. This is what you should be doing Sunday. He says, oh, God, I can't do it. He says, but I want to meet you. I want to meet you for lunch at Quo Vadis in New York, in the city. We were staying out at the Meadowlands in a hotel out there. Yeah. So we fly in, go to the hotel. I check my stuff in. This is a Saturday. This is a Saturday afternoon. I check my stuff in, and then I immediately hit the elevator. I go down and wait for a cab outside the hotel to take me in town. I on the way out, I run into Mike Fanny. He's a defensive tackle for us from Notre Dame, and he's he's from Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm. Country boy.
Oh, man. And he's got a big wad of tobacco in his mouth. And he's standing out there just looking around. And he says, where are you going? I said, I got to go into town. Oh, could I go? Now I'm thinking, I got to go talk to Andy. Yeah, you can come. Get in the car. So he's in the back, and we're driving. I tell the guy, Quo Vadis, New York City, goodbye. Boom. We're driving from the Meadowlands to Quo Vadis. And so Mike starts asking, he says, well, what do you have to go in town for? I says, I don't know. I don't want to. You'll find out. So we get to Quo Vadis. We get out. We go into the restaurant, and Andy's got like five or six people there. And he's got this actress, Susan Blonde, who's in all of his movies and stuff. And she's sitting there next to me. And she says, we're so happy that you were able to get away and come with us and have. Weren't we, Andy? Oh, yeah. It's so good to see you. Now, Andy takes out his tape recorder and he clicks it. And the red light goes on and he places it right in front of me. Reaches over and places it, and now everything starts. So we have this hour and a half. It's hilarious. I wish I had the tape, but we went from all four corners, and I said, "This is Mike. Mike's from Tulsa. This is Andy. Andy introduced everybody. This is Susan Blonde. She's in all Andy's movies. She's a fantastic talent, you know, all that stuff." And so he goes, oh, yeah. So Mike is now speechless. He's sitting next to me. There's a guy sitting across from him who's as gay as the wind. He's just standing, staring at Mike, because Mike keeps ordering these salads that come out on a saucer of salad. And he's powering this down while the interview's going on. And the guy says, God, you can really eat. And now the whole thing's over with. We go back outside. Andy's limo pulls up. The guy gets out, opens the door, and I walk over to Andy. And I give him a hug. I said, it's great to see you. And he says, too bad you don't want to go to the game. I'll call you later. Guy, he gets in and he drives off. Now, I'm now turning. I walk to the corner where Mike's waiting for me to get a cab. And he looks at me and then looks down at the road as the limo's pulling away. And he shakes his head and he said, man, I'll tell you something. Andy Warhol shows up in Tulsa. He gets his ass kicked. Words of wisdom from Mike Fanny.
Oh, my God. That is an incredible story.
Putting Mike Fanny next to Andy.
You know, you know the meteorologists, you know when they know it's going to rain? Yeah. When a high-pressure system meets a low-pressure system, it collides, it makes rain. Yeah. You made a thunderstorm at the restaurant.
Oh, at the hotel. The decision to put Andy and Mike together was one of my greater moments.
So when Howard Stern is interviewed by Jerry Seinfeld for this coffee thing that he does, they both look at each other, so how did you know that you made it in life? And they both say, when I was in Mad Magazine. This is the criteria that Jerry Seinfeld and Howard Stern realized here in Mad Magazine. And I've become very good friends with the best artist that ever drew for Mad Magazine, Mort Drucker. I should put on Twitter the portrait that Mort Drucker did of me. But I brought today to breakfast the January 1972 issue of Mad Magazine, because in the magazine is Mad's Rhyming Guide to Pro Football, written by Frank Jacobs and by Jack Davis. And the TV crew, the color man, I just want to read the poem. This year, 5 million fans will squawk about this man's obnoxious talk. He's got a gift for nasty cracks and second-guessing quarterbacks. With flannel gums and voice of tin, he loves to throw his 2 cents in. From what we hear, we've got to say that 2 cents won't buy much today. And it's a beautiful picture of Howard Cosell.
Exactly.
Tell me about Fred Dreyer's interaction opinion of the great Howard Cosell.
Howard and I were neighbors in New York City.
Oh, my God.
I was on 64th between 2nd and 3rd, and he was just a block away. And oh, he would be on the corner every morning about 8:15, with his top coat and a cigar, waiting for his driver to come by and pick him up, take him over to ABC.
Wow.
And I'd come out of there, and I was headed across downtown to Horn and Hardart's, right above the Lexington Avenue subway. Mm-hmm. And so I go in there to get some oatmeal and stuff. I go downstairs to catch the train and go out to Yankee Stadium to practice.
Wow.
And then, you know, we'd take the climb down and come through right around the corner and go into the first base side of the stadium where Giants locker room was. Yeah. So I would pass Howard. I'd see him. I'd see him all the time.
Unbelievable.
I'd say, Howard, I said, I'm surprised. I'm surprised you're so vulnerable. I mean, if I was driving a cab and I knew you were standing out here, you'd be in trouble.
You'd end up in Oklahoma.
Number 89 from San Diego State. They said he was too small, but he proved them wrong.
What a great invitation. And with that, we'll take a break. We'll pay some bills. So much fun talking to the great Fred Dreyer here on the Weekend Warriors Show on ESPN LA 710. The number is 877-710 ESPN. Welcome back, Weekend Warriors. In 8.5 years that I'm doing this show, I just wish you could be listening to the stories I'm being told during the commercials. Fred Dreyer, you're just incredible.
Well, thank you.
Tomorrow, I'm going to get up at 4 a.m, go surfing. And as I've done for over 25 years, and I'm going to go to the same place in Ventura for a donut. It's called Good Time Donuts. And it's waiting for me already because they're up at 4:30 in the morning making these donuts. It's sugar and cinnamon, and it's an old-fashioned donut. It's not like the deep-fried type of donut. And I'm sitting here today, I'm thinking, God, is that going to taste so good with a cup of coffee? So when you go, make sure you say hello to Sue at Good Time Donuts, my favorite place to eat before I get in the ocean to go surfing. Have you ever gone surfing, Fred?
A long time ago when I was a kid, yeah.
Did you enjoy it? I guess not, because you didn't pursue it.
I didn't enjoy it.
Too tall.
I would, not so much that. It was the circle of friends that I had weren't in that
group.
I would rather go out and body surf, which I did a lot when I was a kid, but I didn't use the boards that much.
Got it. All right, let's I went to a lecture this week, and it was just such a warm, fuzzy feeling for me to hear from a teacher for me, teaching me about how the body works in a way, after doing it for 30 years, for someone to kind of open my eyes to a new way of seeing things. And this Dr. Freddie Fu explaining to me, in his opinion, the sneakers, the cleats, the contact that the athlete has with the surface you're playing on, whether it's a basketball court or a football field, the artificial turf versus real turf, how much that plays a role in injury.
You bet.
Teach me. You did this. You got to experience natural turf as a football player and then artificial turf. Does it make sense to you as a player, the effect that the shoe has on injuries?
It's changed the sport forever, and not in a good way. I used to get a schedule and look through the schedule to see how many turf games we had. And I left the Giants. One of the reasons I left there was I didn't like their physicians. I didn't like how they treated the kids, the guys, the injury guys. And the other thing was is that the Giants were going to move in out of Yankee Stadium. They're going to move across town, across the river to another state, and have artificial turf in the new stadium. And I said, I'm not playing on that. And I don't want to be around any place where I have to play at least half the games, half my games of the year on artificial surface. So I wanted to go back to L.A. or San Diego where they had natural turf. And I've seen a tremendous amount of injuries because what happens is the traction, the grip is on the surface, not through the spikes into dirt. That gives away, that's a natural progression of putting heel toe to ground and then digging and pushing off and having it release in a timely fashion where there's less drag on your legs and your back as you can possibly imagine. You change that dynamic. You start to run flat-footed on turf. You have a tendency not to be on the balls of your feet. You don't go heel toe. You kind of slap your way through wherever you have to go, especially from my position. You know, if everything was to the left of me, I was on the right as a right defensive end. Mm-hmm. So everything that I saw coming at me was through my left eye. And so I had to redo all the padding in my knees, turn them upside down, turn the knee pads upside down, and tape them to my bottom of my leg, where they would just come up and cover my knee in a cap-like situation. Mm-hmm. And I had to tape my arms and my elbows, and I had to tape. The turf burns that you would get lasted you years.
Wow.
You know, and until they realized, you know, you put a lot of cortisporin on them and never let it scab up. And if you were lucky and you didn't hurt it the next week, you could probably get through it. But all of that stuff, all the traction that was necessary to play was so unnatural and uncomfortable. I was so sore, my back, my knees, ankles, everything was just to get through the game. It was just too much of an ordeal.
Your point is that Newton's law, for every action, there's an opposite and equal reaction.
Oh, yeah, big time, especially on turf.
So when you make contact with your foot onto the turf, the energy of striking the ground as the foot goes from heel strike, mid stance to toe off.
Right.
The very fact that the teeth of the cleat is spitting out dirt and grass allows that release, as you're talking about, of the energy to occur. If you don't have that dirt flying, grass flying release of the cleat hitting the turf, and it's concrete with carpeting on top, all of that energy got to go somewhere.
It goes up your leg to your knee.
It goes up your leg into your knee.
Into your knee,
wow.
Up into your hip, into your lower back.
Wow.
God forbid if you engage, you know, I'm a smaller end, and a 310, 25-pound guy comes out at me, explodes, and I have to engage him, and my job is to engage him, stalemate him, control wow. him from pushing me or hooking me, and then look past him to where the flow goes away or comes at me, and then get rid of him. And once you get rid of him, then you can flatten out or do what you have to do to get to the ball. But at that moment you're engaged with him, you're stuck to the ground, just like if I were to hammer you to the ground with a nail. You cannot unweight yourself. It's dangerous, especially if you have double teams, the tight end coming down on you. I've seen guys get stuck, and it was a terrible accident. We were playing, where was it? Oh, we're playing Houston, in Houston. And Bill Curry, the old center from the Colts, was in Houston there. And he this was the Astrodome. They I went out for a kicking, for the kicking, punting stuff before the game to get out of the locker room. I couldn't take it. So I go out there and I walked over to a guy who's on the Oilers, and I was talking with him. We're right around second base. And I looked down and the cutout, the dirt cutout on the baseball field was hemmed in by 2x4s, and then they lay, you stretch over a piece of artificial turf to cover up the dirt for the three bases, first, second, and third base, and pitcher's mound and home plate. So I'm standing there looking at it, and the 2x4 is like 2.5 inches sticking up.
Oh my God!
And so I yelled over to the guy, the guy driving a golf cart. I said, "Come here," and I said, I pointed. I said, "What the hell is that?" And he says, "Oh, that damn thing!" And he reaches in the back of his little golf cart and pulls out a sledgehammer and starts beating the hell out of the things and pushes and drives this thing down below ground level.
Oh my God!
He says, "Yeah." He says that thing always pops up. Now during the game,
it popped up.
I found out. This is amazing. We had a timeout. Earl Campbell was the size of a truck. He was running all over the damn place. So we had a TV timeout. We're all huddled, and I'm bent over in the huddle, and I look down, and I look at the 2x4, and the 2x4 starts moving its way up. I couldn't take it. I said, "I've got artificial surface. I've got 2x4s, and Earl Campbell, the big three.
Time to retire.
The big three."
Oh, my God. All right, we'll take a break. We'll pay some bills. I want to play a soundbite, Fred, of Ray Charles being asked if a magician could wave a wand over your head and you can get your sight back, would you say yes? And I want you to listen with me at what he says and what it means to you. All right?
Yep.
Coming up next with the great Fred Dreyer here on the Weekend Warrior Show on ESPN LA 710. How blessed am I to be able to host a show. Thank you, Ben Lyons on Twitter, for such a nice comment. I love you, Ben Lyons. But to be able to spend time with Fred Dreyer to talk about life. And yes, you have to take it seriously to succeed. Nobody knows that better than you, Fred Dreyer, about what it takes to succeed in football, in the art world, and in life. But you also have to bring with it a sense of humor. The Greeks knew it best. Tragedy and comedy, they go together.
Yeah.
So I want you to listen to Ray Charles, one of the greatest artists of our lifetime, who's blind. You appreciate his work, his song, but you always have that feeling, I feel so bad for that guy. I got news for you. Don't feel so bad for Ray Charles, because he don't feel bad about it. What an unbelievable interview. Listen, and I want to hear your thoughts. We only have a few minutes left.
Yeah, I remember the standard things, you know, green, brown, yellow, white, black, things like that. But these new colors they got, you know, like electric pink.
New colors.
I don't know what the devil that looks like.
Isn't that green?
A new color. But here's the best. This is Ray Charles. If we could wave a wand over your head, would you want to be able to see? The obvious answer is yes. Listen to what Ray Charles says.
Well, let's put it this way. If you were to say to me, "Look, I can wave a wand and you can see right now, and it's got to be a forever thing," I might turn it down. If you were to say to me, "Well, I can wave it and you can see for maybe a day," I might accept that. Only because there are a couple of things that maybe I would like to see once you know, or, you know, just so that I really would know for what's really happening that I haven't seen. Yeah, because, you know, I, as I said, you know, that I've seen the stars and the moon and the sun, and I remember my mother. And so I think basically I would probably like to see, you know, just for once, because I see them anyway all the time. Like, you know, like my kids, for instance, you know, just for, you know, just to physically see them. But actually, I'm not all that hung up about seeing things, because I do everything I want to do. I go everywhere I want to go. And with some of the news I hear about today, you know, I mean, there's some things I just absolutely don't want to see, man. And I feel sorry for you guys who have to put up with it.
Oh, my God. We got about a minute left, Dreyer. What do you think about? What are we hearing there?
It's not what you would think. It's great to hear him verbalize your fears for him.
Right.
You know.
You're the master of non-verbal communication. Here's a guy who's blind, who's missing that sense, telling you, I'm doing just fine, thank you very much.
There's so damn many things in the world to experience and to share, and you don't, it's funny, you know, like I was just mentioning to you, it's taken us two hours to really start cracking the surface and to get into stuff. We could go another 2 hours and really cut it up pretty good, you know. But it's like life, you know. I'm 73 years old just last January. I mean, this July I'll be 70. What,
you look 43.
I feel good and I feel great. It's because of, I've got friends like you, Dr. Rob, and no, really, truly. And the experiences I've had have been shared by some of the greatest people you could ever want to meet. Some of the funniest people I've had. Some of the funniest things in life have happened at just when you're, I remember at real quickly, I remember looking at my shoe tops in a huddle in New York one day and then looking around, I said, God, I'm in Yankee Stadium.
Wow.
I'm in Yankee freaking Stadium. I'm in a TV timeout and I'm looking at my shoe tops and I'm looking right out here in center field, right where Mickey Mantle stepped in that drain.
Tweaked his knee.
And tweaked his knee. And when I went over to look at the area, and they hadn't fixed the drain. They didn't fix the drain. I yelled out, you mean to tell me you didn't fix the drain?
Fred, this has been one of the most pleasurable 2 hours I've had in 8.5 years on the radio.
Thank you.
I hope to do this many more. I hope to break down football games with you for some Fox Sports, ESPN, NFL Network someday.
We're going to
do it this season, and I can't wait. ESPN LA, 710.